TFM.
This is J.G. Hertzler, General Mar Talker on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, I noticed you on the promenade walking by. That really nice dress caught your eye, so here, I've brought it to you. Here's a gift.
Chris, I think you may have mistaken my face in that moment. I was trying to hold in the vomit. Maybe that came as a smile or something, or indication that I liked it. But actually, this is hideous. And so I'm so sorry. I appreciate the gesture, but I wouldn't, you know, wish this dress on anyone.
It is awful. It's just hideous. I'm in total agreement with you. And I can see now we've hit it off so well, we're going to have a great discussion.
I hope so. Thank you.
All right, everyone. We are going to not talk about dresses today, but we are going to talk about Sanctuary. It's the 10th episode of Season 2 as we continue our 30th anniversary rewatch of Deep Space Nine. And here is a quick rundown of the story. When a group of refugees from the Gamma Quadrant come through the wormhole, Sisko naturally extends Federation hospitality. These aliens, the Skreeans, flew through what they call the Eye of the Universe in search of their fabled homeworld, Kentana. According to their sacred texts, Kentana was a place where they would plant seeds of joy. There's just one problem. The planet turns out to be Bajor. So, Matthew, that is a little bit of a problem, right? When someone's already living on the planet that you want to go to, and especially when they happen to be the main characters in the TV show you're on.
Yeah, I mean, this is a really interesting episode, and I think it has a lot of things to deal with that, interestingly enough, I would say are probably even more relevant now than when this came out, because the idea of refugees, immigration, and all that kind of stuff has become a much hotter topic within, you know, I would say the last 15 years, 20 years. Mm-hmm. And so I was very interested, knowing what this episode was coming into it, how I was going to feel about it, how I thought they would deal with it. So I'm really excited to actually dive in to talk about this one.
Yeah, well, before we get into the immigration core of the story, I thought it would be interesting to start where the story starts, because there's a technology thing here in this episode that I do find kind of curious, because I've always been fascinated by how a universal translator would work. And It's interesting today, because that technology that seemed so fantastical and futuristic to you and me growing up watching Star Trek is kind of becoming a reality now. And to use it, we need a device like a smartphone or AirPods, which can interpret from language to language on the fly and do a pretty decent job of it, actually. And so you can imagine, like, this has really only been around for, what, about a year or so?
Yeah.
In terms of it being like easily accessible to anybody who has a smartphone or AirPods or a device like that. So you can imagine that 5 years, 10 years from now, how good this is going to be.
Yeah.
So something that felt like, wow, you mean 200-300 years in the future we'll be able to do this is something that's already in our hands now and is only going to improve. And what I find interesting about it here is that we've kind of had this impression, I would say, through the next generation era, that somehow the comm badge plays a role in the how the universal translator would work. Is that how you've understood it as well?
Yeah, no, absolutely. That is exactly how I've understood it, that the comm badge is the key to, you know, making this work.
Yeah. And so here it seems like in ops that it's something broader. It's like the universal translator is just all around you all the time. And like on the fly allows people speaking different languages to just speak in their own language and the other person hears the other one, which is kind of a bizarre concept. I don't know how that would work. And the other thing that I find interesting about the way they approach this in this episode, and I'm curious if you think it makes sense. They've encountered so many aliens in Star Trek up to this point, and the universal translator usually doesn't have any major problem unless it's like clicking insects or something like that, where Picard has to learn a speech. Here, what they created as the Skrian language doesn't seem that odd as a spoken language, and yet the universal translator just can't figure it out. And it kind of goes on and on and on, and it almost feels like it's like a long, long opening so that they can later on use that to build a friendship between Hanik and Kira to kind of propel the story forward, and how Kira has to grapple with her people's distrust of allowing the Skrians to come in and stay on Bajor.
Yeah, I mean, I think the cool thing about the whole idea with the universal translator not working well, what I liked is that we were doing this from a species from the Gamma Quadrant, which I think made a lot of sense, right? You know, if we're going to struggle with you know, people coming through the wormhole, there's a whole new section of space where the idea that languages would be very different in different quadrants of the galaxy, and and so their syntax and everything might be difficult for the universal translator to lock into right away. I thought that idea was really great, that that choice was a really smart choice here. And in a lot of ways, I just thought it was a lot of fun for the episode, and it made it different, right? I think that's the other thing here, is that I think they were trying to find a way in which, and one of the things we've talked about many times, how do you create a story that's truly just Deep Space Nine? And one of the ways you do that is you utilize the idea of the Gamma Quadrant and a new alien species, to which you've got something that you don't really get, which is the universal translator just not being able to keep up at this moment. And to me, that's really smart. I think to me, that's something that makes a lot of sense. And it does kind of create this frustrating aspect to the story, because, you know, in many ways, this is about communicating, you know, across cultures and trying to learn to understand one another. And just because we can speak the same language with one another doesn't mean that we're necessarily always going to come to a perfect understanding, or that everything's going to just turn out hunky-dory, you know? And I like that about this story, because one of the things that it also does for just the series in general, it helps us be reminded that what Deep Space Nine is trying to do is show the messier side of life, right? The not so everything just gets put back into a box and it's clean and neat. That life itself and the choices that we have to make are messy, and it's not always going to be easy to accept the answers, right?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I mean, the cultural communication part, where that is a core part of this story, it does make sense to start out with them not being able to communicate with one another. Yeah, and it's better than my thought that probably the universal translators on the station were still running on Intel chips, and that's why they couldn't keep
as you say. Yeah, it's just so, probably it. Yeah. I mean.
And it does support the idea that, like you said, maybe things were different in the Gamma Quadrant in terms of syntax. And, you know, but of course on Earth languages also, you know, syntax varies. For me, it's interesting because I speak two languages that have reversed syntax. So, you know, in Japanese, we basically, if you were to translate sentences, we say things backwards from English a lot of the time, but it feels perfectly normal when you do it in Japanese. But if you actually stop and think about what you're saying, it seems quite odd. So even on Earth, we've got that. But if you put it on a galactic scale, then yeah, it does make a lot of sense. And it's a nice kind of throwback to, you know, one of the things I like about Enterprise with Hoshi is that they're at a point where they don't have a universal translator yet, and they do encounter aliens who they can't communicate with, and they have to figure out how to do it. And that's something that just pretty much disappears in most cases in Star Trek later on.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think it allows us to realize, and we all experience this today, right? You know, even if you're using some sort of AI program, you know, it's not always 100% effective. And technology, even in the 24th century, is not always going to be 100% effective. It's not always going to be 100% correct. You know, it's always going to have to be learning. You know, when you think about the mass language models of the galaxy, it does make sense that there would be the need for that to be updated, especially as you meet new species and a new part of the galaxy. And so, yeah, I mean, I just love this thought process. I think that they did a really good job with thinking this through for the episode. And it does make it frustrating then for the characters in the story. And it makes it kind of frustrating for the viewer. And I think in a good way, right? To allow a audience to kind of experience the same frustration that our characters are experiencing is, I think, important every once in a while. Sometimes, you know, Star Trek stories can feel like it's just too easy for the characters. And so I appreciate that it was not just easy for them here. So,
well, when the tech companies start talking about MLMGs soon, remember, you heard it here first. Mass language models of the galaxy, they're coming, and Matthew predicted them. So I expect you to become very wealthy in the future.
Oh my gosh.
All right. Well, let's talk about the thing they're concerned about, because that's the core of the story, which is, you know, this, like you said earlier, it's really a story about immigration. And it's one of those cases where there's a lot of these cases in Deep Space Nine, where the story that they were telling in the early 1990s feels even more relevant in today's world, because immigration has always been a concern throughout history, but it's also something that is responsible for building nations and building societies and cultures, especially like the United States, which is, I know from Schoolhouse Rock, when I was growing up, it's a melting pot, right? It's a nation of people who came from all around the world, and they combined their best skills and their traditions and beliefs and everything to create one society. But, you know, over time, that can be fragile, and people can have concerns, people can become fearful. And in today's world, we see it everywhere. You know, we're facing it here in Japan as well. Over the past year in particular, we've been feeling a strong backlash against foreigners, and this belief by some people that the society would be better off if we weren't here, right? So that's something that is happening not only in one place, but kind of all around the globe. You always see it in Europe as well. And it's a very complex subject, right? There's a big difference between legal immigrants, illegal immigrants, refugees, people seeking help to escape war. It's very complex. There are many reasons why people move around. And here, I get what they were trying to do with the story. I think that it is a good story to tell about the Bajorans in the aftermath of the occupation and how they might be feeling about some things. And it's an interesting kind of, it's an interesting story to tell about the mythology of people from the other side of the galaxy. The Eye of the Universe being a name for the wormhole, I thought was interesting. There are some aspects of the story that I think do undermine its impact a little bit, especially the fact that there's a perfectly good planet that the Skreeans can be resettled on, making Bajor not the only potential destination for them.
Yeah, I think this is sort of an interesting story. And when we think about it in the idea of immigration or refugees and how that's handled, and you know, I think you're absolutely right in the sense that this story is not as impactful as it could have been because there is a perfect place for them to be outside of Bajor, right? When we think about these issues in our world, that's not the case, right? You know, making these decisions really becomes about if they can't be here, is there somewhere else for them to be? Because we only have so much space on our planet, right? There's only so many places you can go. We don't get to scan the galaxy, you know, for a new place for people to live. And so I do think that that has an impact then on, like you said, the kind of the punch of the story. And it almost feels like it would have been slightly more interesting to have not made this so cut and dry in that sense. I'm not quite sure how you do that because, again, you're set in space. And so that is always going to be an opportunity for you just because of the reality of Star Trek as we know it. So, but I think the bigger question here, and one that they did not play with specifically, is the idea when you bring people into your country, just like, and this is mirrored with the Federation itself, right? To join the Federation, you have to say that you will agree to the values that the Federation holds dear and sign on to the Federation Constitution, right? As as what you will be living by. Anytime somebody comes into one's country, you know, the idea that they would then adapt themselves to the culture and the values and belief system of what makes those values possible in that new culture, and then be able to influence it by just being who they are and where they come from. I think that was the idea that we got back in the day of the melting pot. I think that's all gotten mixed up now from what we've seen very many places around the world where people are moving to countries but then have no desire to assimilate whatsoever. And that creates huge issues. And so
you end up having enclaves of people who build kind of like miniature communities.
Yes.
That mimic the culture they came from with no interest in assimilating into the new culture that they've moved to.
And I would say that's probably another point for this episode, that because these people don't seem as though that's going to be an issue either for them. Take away from some of the impact of the story, you know, and so, but and on the opposite end and the completely negative end, this isn't a decision that's made for xenophobic reasons, right? And so, I think that's another thing that those three issues allow this to be not as heightened as a story, not as kind of, you know, one of the things we talked about a little bit earlier in the episode is the idea that Deep Space Nine was always a little bit less clean, a little less gray. It was a little more gray than the black and white we kind of got in the original series. And then, of course, absolutely, it was continued in many ways in TNG, right? There was always a right answer. It felt like almost all the time. And Deep Space Nine becomes a show that begins to play more with the gray areas when you begin to mix all these cultures together. And that's just not something we see really in this episode either. So it's not a bad episode in any way, but I do think that there are some hallmarks of Deep Space Nine that if this episode had been done later in the series, would have probably played out differently.
Yeah. One thing that's interesting about this episode in terms of how it developed and then how it turned out, which may have changed the way that it was resolved or the way you perceive it when you watch it or whatever, is that Frederick Rappaport, who wrote the teleplay, has said that the original idea for the story was that these alien boat people would be rescued by DS9. So that's one thing where you can imagine if you just have a boat of people. So I know what boat people means, but just a small number of people anyway who are coming in, which is what we end up with here because we have this initial group that's coming. It's easier to look at a group of people like that and say, okay, we need to extend a helping hand. We need to rescue them and let's find a solution for them. But the reality of the Skreeans is that there are millions of more coming. So if they were to settle on Bajor, it isn't just that this group of people that we see in the episode are going to settle on Bajor. It's that millions of Skreeans are going to settle on Bajor. So that's where you start talking about, if you take in millions of people from another planet, in this case, or say another country on our own world, how do you prevent that from simply being like a transplant? You know, I mentioned you have an enclave earlier. How do you stop that from being a transplant that then begins to threaten your culture? And so it is natural 100%. That people would be concerned about that. So I can understand the position of Bajorans here who are cautious about taking on such a large number of people, and they're looking out at the potential because they're coming off the occupation where they've already had their culture significantly impacted by an alien presence on their planet. Now, that was a hostile one, and this one is said to be peaceful, and they just want to settle on this world, and they're farmers, and they're offering to help to rebuild Bajor with their farming skills. And Rappaport also created that element, the botanical skills that Hanik and Tumak talk about, as a possible reason why the Bajorans would allow them to settle. And then in the end, Michael Piller stepped in and said, you know, this would have more impact on the viewer if it does not have a happy ending. And so then we end up with the ending that we have where they're not allowed to stay. But I think that, you know, keeping in mind what we were talking about, the scale of it is an important element of the story to figure out whether you feel like the Bajorans are just being stubborn, difficult, rejecting outsiders, whatever, versus having a legitimate concern. Because you can imagine, even if they settle them on an area of the planet where there no one's living right now, extrapolate that out a couple of hundred years, you could end up with a hostile community on the other side of your planet that leads to conflict on the planet itself down the road. So, you know, those are things that you would need to think about.
I mean, I think that what you're saying in when we're talking about this idea of the Bajoran concerns, the reality of bringing 3 million people to your planet and trying to absorb that after the 50 years of occupation that Bajor has sustained makes complete sense as to why this would be an issue, because they have to think about the reality of, yes, we project that this could be okay, but there are always variables to which we don't have any thought process on and can't even think about. We couldn't even put into a computer model to figure out, right? And in this moment, we do have to think about our own concerns. At the same time, too, and this is one of the things to which many countries around the world are seeing, is that when you have a large influx of people from a certain area, that causes and can cause many big issues. And it is in many places around the world. US, we've seen it in France, you're seeing it in England. There are many places in the world where Germany has experienced this. It's a big issue. And a big part of that is just down to the amount of people that have come in such a short amount of time. And so I applaud the writers for actually not allowing this to have that kind of quote-unquote happy ending, because the reality of the question that the Bajorans are having to ask is one that every country has to ask in this. And there is, thankfully, another option for them here that is, in the end, just as good for the Skreans, really, as it is for the Bajorans. And I think...
probably better, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
Because they would have their own world.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, they will be able to create the culture in many ways that they lost, that had been taken away from them by the Dominion.
Yeah.
And I think there's something beautiful about that, because in many ways, they might not even understand necessarily quite what they've lost just yet, because they're just tasting their first a bit of freedom. And there, again, that could create issues with the Bajorans down the road. And so and I think that's the other part that really doesn't kind of get touched on in the issue that I think the Bajorans could have brought up, which is to say, we are in a position that you are, but we're just a little bit ahead of you. But we've realized that right now, it is important for us to recapture what it means to be Bajoran as a society before we jump into the larger whole of the galaxy. It's a, you know, they could even, and this is what it, where I think the writing could have been really good, but to even show, hey, you know, this is why we haven't just immediately jumped into the idea of becoming Federation citizens, because we need to figure out what who we are as a people before we insert ourselves into the larger fabric of the universe in this way. And thankfully, Starfleet is here to help us allow to do that and keep us safe to allow to do that. And we want that for your people. If that had been a speech that had been given, I think would have been phenomenal. And that would have made the episode bittersweet, right? Because I think that would have helped you have a happy ending without having, quote unquote, the happy ending we all necessarily expected when the episode first started.
I do think the lack of any sort of happy ending, it feels true for DS9 storytelling. But in real life, yeah, what you describe would be good. The other thing about if they had decided to settle on Draylon 2, which is the planet that the DS9 crew had found for them, which seemed ideal for them, because they're being settled there by the Federation, they're going to have like ongoing support from the Federation, probably. Like the Federation's going to check in on them, probably going to protect them. You know, they,
more so
there were
than
a lot
SETI
of
Alpha 6.
Yeah, well.
Or SETI Alpha 5, excuse me. So,
you know, what happens in the SETI Alpha system stays in the SETI Alpha system.
Yeah, absolutely.
but... no, there were a lot of benefits for them, but I think their mythology kind of got in the way where they feel this is like they're destined to live on Bajor. Like that's where they're meant to be, and so they just don't want to consider any other option. So it kind of clouds the view for the Skreans, maybe, at least for these Skreans.
Yeah. I mean, I think the real beauty of the episode and the thing that makes it the most interesting is the rewatchability, in the sense, because this becomes a real Dominion breadcrumbs episode. And, you know, this is the second episode in which they're mentioned, and they are seen as being an incredible threat.
Yeah, just the reaction on the faces of the crew when they hear that name. They're like, I mean, they don't know what it is yet, but they know, okay, something ominous about this.
Yeah. I think it's fantastic that the way that they're building this, right? It's really well done when you look back on the series that, you know, and it's going to take us a while to get there, right?
Mm-hmm.
But utilizing the Skrians in this way is brilliant. I think that it's one of the things that we're always talking about, and I think I'm always just so shocked that they were able to pull it off, is that, you know, it's not often that a writing group doesn't necessarily have the plan figured out from the beginning, and yet when you go back, it seems to make more sense than when you saw it the first time. And that is just, I don't know, man. It's definitely special.
Yeah. It seems like they were slowly building to something big that they had planned, right? But instead, right, they're just cautiously filling it out.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like to do that. I like to, like, drop a keyword into conversations off and on. People think I'm building up to something, and then might pay off down the road. You never know.
It could.
One other thing that I did like about this episode is that they made an effort to do something different with the aliens. I thought the Skrian makeup was pretty creepy. I mean, if you think about it, and this is similar to something that Ira Stephen Bear had said about it. If you think about, like, people come over as guests and they want to stay. Maybe I can picture someone trying to find a new roommate. Sounds like something from a sitcom from the 90s, but people keep coming over and they're trying to make themselves, trying to make you feel comfortable around them. But then pieces of their face just keep flaking off everywhere. It's going to be pretty disgusting. And I think it was a subtle way. What's
that? Is their shampoo face and shoulders?
Face and shoulders, yeah.
Because they've got skin dandruff. So
yeah, it's a combination shampoo, conditioner, and skin moisturizer.
Yeah.
Oh man, but it's kind of a subtle way though to make it for the viewer as well. Mm-hmm. Like, you can kind of feel how, what's a way to say it? Like, when people meet someone from the outside, depending on how different they are. So it can happen in our own world as well, based on skin color, mannerisms, things like this. But there are different degrees to which something like that can make you feel uneasy. And here, that's only contributing to the unease that the Bajorans feel about the idea of having the Skrians settle there. Now, not saying that's right. That's a superficial thing that, of course, you should try to not let influence your decisions or how you view people. But in reality, it does. And that's just a fact of life. And it was sort of an unspoken support here for the idea that they were trying to get across in the story.
Yeah. No, I think all of this kind of works together really well. And I guess, you know, for me, my final thoughts on this one are, I think it is a good episode. It's a solid episode. And I think, you know, it has implications, of course, for the future. I think it does a great job for also the character of Kira, putting her in a really difficult position of, you know, she was a person at the beginning of the series who did not want the Federation to be there. She didn't think that the Bajorans needed help. And what we see here is that not only is she a person who has come to accept and be thankful for the assistance of the Federation for the Bajoran people, but she's seeing that her people are not in a place to be able to do that for others yet. And I think that's a really just interesting character dynamic. So, yeah, I mean, I think I would give this 3.5 out of 5 skin cells left over from a Skrian in Quark's bar. So
I'm worried Quark's going to try to turn those into some kind of drink or...
Ugh. Ugh.
That's or bar, so bar bites. So, yeah, I also think it's a good episode. I mean, it has a good social commentary. I think that if they were bolder with the writing, it could have hit home a little harder and been more, had a stronger social message to it. They kind of... This happens with quite a few early episodes where they start with a premise, it doesn't quite work, and then they kind of figure out an angle on how to make it work, and then they make some adjustments to it that probably allow the story to play out and be more successful than the original idea, but sometimes don't quite give it the punch that it needs. I do wonder, like, if they were to write a story like this on television today, just imagine Deep Space Nine is being written today. So I'm not saying on one of the new Star Trek series, but on this series, just with the sensibilities of TV storytelling today, if they might be a little bit bolder to make a little stronger statement than they did and not try to make it still fit into the kind of Roddenberry mold of what Star Trek is as much.
Yeah.
But no, I think it's a... I think it's a very good episode, and it certainly makes me think about a lot of issues in my own world right now that I'm kind of surrounded by. So I'm going to give this one 6 recipes by that budding bug chef in the Dabo section of Quark's that I think Nog's really going to like.
Oh my gosh. Oh my.
All right, everyone. We would love to hear your thoughts on Sanctuary. There are many ways for you to share those with us. Perhaps the best way is to go to Facebook and join the Babel Conference. That is our listeners group. It's there to extend the conversations beyond the podcasts. So if you're joining for the first time, please do answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. You'll see a post there on the timeline for this episode, and you can share your thoughts with Matthew and me and fellow listeners right there. Of course, you can also send us email. Go to our website, trek.fm/contact, and use the form you find there. Choose to send to a show and choose the orb, and that'll come right through the eye of the universe to us by email. Of course, you can find us in social media. Our username everywhere is trekfm. And if your podcast app of choice allows you to leave a rating and a review, we'd love to get that from you as well. Now, Matthew, when you're not telling people how Inta'oa their dress is, where can people find you?
Well, it takes a lot of time, Chris. Too many ugly dresses out there. But you can find me all over social media under the name MattRushing02, of course, here on the network. Got a lot of great talk over in the 602 Club as we discuss all of the franchises we love outside of Star Trek. And then you can also find me on the Nerd Party Network with a couple of shows. One is called Owlpost. We talk about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series, one chapter at a time. And on Aggressive Negotiations, talking about Star Wars with the great John Mills every single week. But Chris, when you're not trying to figure out why that universal translator is not working with that AI friend that you just made, where can people find you?
My good old AI friend. Yeah, you can find me elsewhere on the network doing all those shows with you, of course. Larry Nemechek and I have a new episode of The Ready Room out now, where we look back at season 3 of Strange New Worlds. And of course, you can find me in the back catalog across many shows from the last 15 plus years if you'd like to hear my thoughts on a wide range of topics from the Star Trek universe. And you can also find me on social media. My username is C. Brian Jones, the letter C and Brian with a Y. Blue Sky is where I'm most active, but you can find me everywhere, so drop me a line. And if you'd like to help us keep this rewatch and everything we're doing on the network going, we could definitely use your help. To find out how to support the network, please visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. We would not be here without your support, so thank you to everyone who is supporting us now. Well, Matthew, get your racket ready because we're going to have a match of space racquetball next time as we talk about Rivals.
Well, Chris, I can't wait. And thank you, everybody, for joining us. And we will see you next time. as we gaze into the orb.